Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gutterblog. James, good morning to you.
Morning, Andrew. How are you?
I don't like this. I'd forgotten. Maybe there's, something wrong with my memory. But everything was going so well. Everything was nice and good, and I liked it. And now I don't like it. I don't like this at all.
Well, Kim Chalstrom strum... Hang on, what's this person's name on the Discord? Kim Chow strumming myself silly has said, not a question, just trying to find a silver lining here. At least the guy who hates Goodly Mornings will be happy.
Well, you know, as I said a couple of weeks ago, and with all due respect to our listeners, fuck that guy.
Yeah. It's an unfamiliar feeling in this calendar year. We've had a very good run. But, very annoying to lose yesterday.
And frustrating. And, you know, I think it is. Maybe it's something we can explore a little bit later on, this feeling of, I don't know, like a gut punch, despite the fact that this is the first time we've lost in 2024. And we've, you know, won 10 and drawn one of our last 11 games and lost this one. And by any standards, I think that's an exceptional run of form, and yet here we are feeling downhearted and dismayed and bereft and all of those things because of, you know, the context of the Premier League these days and what we've got to contend with and what we've got to compete with and everything else. But it is interesting, isn't it, that, you know, it does feel so... Like, didn't I say a couple of weeks ago, I think we need to win 8 of our 9 games to have a chance of winning the Premier League. So the whatever little margin for error that might have been there, I think, is gone.
It does seem that way. It is kind of remarkable how flat everybody feels and the extent to which people are reacting So negatively, when you sort of step back and say, well, you know, we're only 2 points off top spot. It's a one game swing. Liverpool didn't gain any ground on us. But I think it's just I think it's two things. I think first and foremost, it's the fact of we're up against Man City. And there's just that feeling that if you give them an inch, they can take a mile. Mm-hmm. You know, if you hand them the initiative at this stage of the season, they're pretty good at closing it out. And I think maybe as well, it's a little bit of baggage that we're carrying from last season where I think on some deep level, we suspect that once the run is kind of halted, that may mean the wheels are coming off entirely.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think that is, you know, I've spoken to obviously people and friends and what have you, and there is that deep-lying fear that this result might reverberate and it might mean that, as you say, the wheels come off or we just sort of lose our momentum and stutter over the finish line rather than charge across it in a sprint, you know, which I think is fair. You know, I understand it because I think it is a consequence of last season, but also, you know, you're right that this is a scenario we've seen before with Manchester City, though. At this point of the season, if they get ahead, they stay ahead. We've seen this fucking film 115 times already. And it's very, very hard to escape that reality. You know, that is just what we have become accustomed to, rightly, wrongly, or otherwise. And I say wrongly, obviously, because of how the financial landscape has enabled Manchester City to do what they do. But that is the reality. There's no escaping that it is the reality we exist in.
I think so. And I think there are probably two other factors that might be contributing to quite how low everyone's feeling this Monday morning. One is that when we looked at our fixtures, I think we were all probably guilty of kind of looking at the home games and seeing them as bankers. You know, I think there was a lot of talk about the away trips to maybe White Hart Lane or Old Trafford as being potential scenarios where we drop points. But I think we all thought, well, we'll win the home games, you know. And so to have lost one of those feels like a big blow. And I think as well, you've got to look at the week maybe rather than just the Villa game and say, you know, were there some worrying signs across both games, Bayern and Villa? A bit like Liverpool, we didn't have a great week.
Yeah.
And for this Arsenal team to concede 4 goals in 2 games, that feels quite uncharacteristic.
Yeah.
And that feels like something has changed. And I guess that adds to the worry.
Well, you know, as we have seen this season already, you can have, and this Arsenal team has had, a bad week here and there, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't know, can we sneak in a trip to Dubai ahead of the game on Wednesday? I'm not sure we can, you know. But look, we'll come to that because I do think, you know, for all the fear and the anxiety, there is still a lot to play for. You know, this, as much as it feels inevitable, there are 6 games to go. We're only 2 points behind. Mad things can happen in football. And the important thing for Arsenal right now is the reaction to this game. And that's something Arteta was keen to talk about afterwards. And it is the right way to sort of address this publicly. The reaction, because there is still a lot to play for, is absolutely crucial. However, we're here to talk about yesterday and talk about a 2-0 defeat to Aston Villa. A game, I have to say, that I don't think we should have lost based on, you know, what we did in the first half, what I think this team is capable of. There's an element of a little bit of sucker punch to the way that the game played out. And I think it was very much a game of two halves, where the first half, Arsenal were, you know, obviously a lot better than they were in the second half. I also think Villa were a lot better than they were in the first half. And those are the key issues, I think. You were a bit surprised, because I watched your video, you were a bit surprised at the starting lineup. Kai Havertz moving back into midfield, Gabriel Jesus starting up top, Leandro Trossard on the left-hand side, and Zinchenko in at left-back, which I don't think was necessarily a surprising selection. And I kind of want to leave Zinchenko to part two, because I have a question or two about him. So we can talk about him in a bit more detail in part two. But you were a little bit worried. Worried, is that the right word? Or would you have preferred to see Havertz, you know, starting up top again and sort of continuing the structure that we've had?
I mean, I would have preferred that personally. I suppose I should have seen this coming, because on Friday I was at Mikel Arteta's press conference and I asked him a couple of questions about Kai Havertz playing up front. And said, you know, do you think he seems more comfortable there? Do you think he seems happier there? And I was quite surprised that Mikel sort of completely batted that away. He was like, no, I think he's did just as well, you know, as a number 8 as he did as a number 9.
Mm.
And I sort of went away sort of scratching my head thinking, why has he said that? Because I'm not, personally, I don't think it's true. And I guess it's because he already knew what team he was going to pick on Sunday.
Maybe so, yeah.
I think... Yeah, I've got a clear preference. I think Havertz gives the team better structure when he plays through the middle. And I think we benefit more from having, you know, a kind of second ball playing midfielder there. I just feel that a midfield three of Rice, Havertz and Odegaard, I love Declan Rice and I think Kai Havertz is a really handy player, but for me, they're not quite the sort of top level forward passes that we needed.
I mean, do you think it was a case that Arteta looked at Aston Villa and saw no Douglas Luiz, no Kamara, they've no Jacob Ramsey, central midfield was not going to be as strong, we're at home, this is a game where we want to get another attacking player on the pitch, so you put Havertz into midfield again? I tend to agree with you with regards Havertz at this moment in time. I think we're better with him up top. I think he is a very willing player. I think he worked really hard yesterday. He runs really well, got back to defend.
Yeah.
You know, I think the overall level of the commitment of his performance, if I can put it like that, was good because he didn't shirk his defensive duty and he was getting into good positions, making that run from that sort of inside left channel, if you want to say left eight, into that inside left forward position.
Yep.
The problem was that when he got back to defend, I don't think he's quite good enough on the ball to be able to link play the way we want, having won it back. And when he got into those positions in the opposition box, there just wasn't quite enough decisiveness from him in the final action, with a couple of shots, with a couple of moments where he could have got in behind. And I think that as well was, what's the word I'm looking for here? Exacerbated a little bit by the fact that when you have Gabriel Jesus up front, you have a guy who's efficiency in the final third has been an issue / talking point since the day he arrived at this football club. You know, finishing is not what it should be for a center forward, for a number nine, for a team like Arsenal. Some of the moments, some of the positions he got into yesterday, as has often been the case with him, were fantastic. But the final pass or the attempt on goal, just not quite at the level you need. So if you're putting Kai Havertz back in midfield for a clinical goal scorer, I get it. But, you know, when it's someone like Jesus whose end product isn't where it should be, I think it causes another problem for us.
Yeah, I to be clear, I don't think Havertz was particularly bad individually at all. I thought he worked really hard, like you said, and he did lots of good things in the game. I just think structurally, we are better with him leading the line and with an extra midfield player in there. But I also accept that from Mikel's perspective, you know, he has to rotate at some point in time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jorginho probably can't play all these games. And, you know, he's only got so many choices he can make. I mean, I heard Clive say yesterday that in some ways it feels like we need two Kai Havertzes and two Declan Rices. And I think there's some truth in that.
Mm.
But, yeah, so I that aspect of the starting 11 I worried about, just because it kind of disrupted a structure that's been working so brilliantly for us. But as you say, we certainly had our moments in the first half. And I think the second half's obviously a really different story. And I think Villa were comfortably the better side in that half. But if we get an early goal or two, it completely changes the pattern of the game. And ultimately, we didn't do that. And it cost us very dear.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that the front three, is it the front three? I would include Havertz, obviously, because I just mentioned some of the moments that he had. However, there were opportunities for our players in those forward positions, not least because Martin Odegaard had an unbelievable first half.
Yeah.
I thought the way he controlled the game, dictated our rhythm in the final third, was excellent. And I find it astonishing. This is a guy who only has 6 or 7 assists in the Premier League this season. I think he has been, to some extent, let down by the players ahead of him because his creativity was on show yesterday. There were moments, so many nearly moments for Arsenal where we did get players in behind. Bukayo Saka in behind a couple of times early on. The quality of the final ball wasn't there. There was the Saka cross for Jesus at the back post. He heads wide at the back post. I mean, you've got to hit the target there. You've got to go back across the goal, I think, to try and work the goalkeeper. Yeah. There was the Trossard pass for Havertz. The shot was saved. A couple of Havertz runs in behind. I think maybe one was given offside. A brilliant Odegaard pass to Saka where he took a heavy touch. First touch was heavy and he whacked it with his right foot wide of the near post. Go back across goal. I think there were a couple of moments as well where, you know, we tried to loft across or put across on the head of somebody where I think if we'd just gone low, hard across the box, there were so many legs in there, as we saw with the, was it the own goal against Smith Rowe forced the own goal. I think that was against Luton. You know, a couple of moments like that where the quality of the final ball into the opposition box was not where it needed to be, and the decision-making and some of the finishing, not where it needed to be. And, you know, I have to say that at halftime, I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. At halftime, I was like, okay, this is not great. I'm a bit nervous, but I'm, you know, mostly encouraged by the positions that we got ourselves into. And if we can repeat that in the second half and you know, deliver better final balls, I thought the goals were going to be there for us.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. I mean, the big chance for me was the Trossard one.
Yes.
You know, you would expect him to take that. Equally, it's one of those where he just sort of hits it early, and if it's literally a couple of inches away from the keeper, it's probably in the back of the net. Mm. It's one of those, isn't it? But
for me, it's more a miss than a, you know, on.
Oh, yeah, I agree. You know, keeper doesn't know a lot about it.
I mean, he sticks his foot out, you know, because that's what he's going to do anyway. I just think with, look, I accept it's happening in a split second. You've often talked about Trossard as being the best finisher, and I think if you were to ask me, pick an Arsenal player to be in that exact position for that exact pass, I think I would have chosen Trossard as well. But there was a lot of the goal to aim at, and he just went a bit too close to the keeper. So for me, that is a bad miss rather than a good save, and a bit of a sliding doors moment in this game, because I, you know, it's impossible not to think about how things might have been different if, you know, we'd made the pressure pay and gone in ahead at halftime, because I think that would have been, you know, 1-0 lead at the break.
I agree with that, but I would add it, you know, we might have been behind as well. Mm-hmm. There was a big moment with Ollie Watkins, Gabriel, kind of for the second game of succession, really, didn't quite deal with the ball properly, ended up kicking it against Zinchenko, and Watkins ran through and hit the post. I think that would have been at that point in time against the run of play, but it was a bit of a warning sign. And I guess, you know, if you're coming up against Watkins, you're facing a player who's bang in form, who's a threat in behind. He's scored plenty of goals against us in the past. So that was just a kind of, you know, that kind of kept my nerves on edge a little bit as well at the other end of the pitch.
That was just before the Trossard chance, actually.
Right, yeah.
And you know, hindsight and all that, and I just wonder if that might have been a better time to concede a goal if we were going to concede a goal, you know. Obviously, yeah, I'm glad we didn't, and it was very, very close. It was a mistake by Gabriel, and we got away with one there, and then I think there was a late free kick as well, wasn't there? Gabriel got a yellow card for that. But that was sort of the extent of Villa's threat in that first half, and it came because we made a mistake, and I think that probably harks back to the game against Bayern in midweek, where the two goals we conceded were down to us, really, more than what Bayern did.
Mm-hmm.
And that shakiness, I think, that you referenced a few minutes ago is probably part of why people are just, you know, concerned and feeling a bit nervous about Wednesday and what lies beyond Wednesday. But like we said, second half, I find it hard to understand quite what happened, because you can imagine that the halftime team talk was probably, okay, not brilliant, but like, keep going, keep doing it, keep plugging away, keep finding those spaces, keep making those runs, and the goal will come. But I don't even think Villa did very much tactically to get on top of the game in the second half. And I think my biggest concern or criticism about this half is that we, or certainly Mikel Arteta, was not able to react or didn't react well enough from the bench to change the momentum of the game. By the time he made his first changes, you know, it was Tomiyasu for Ben White, it was Martinelli for Trossard, but I don't think those changes necessarily did anything to impact what way that game was going and what Villa were doing, which again was like being a bit dominant in possession, probably having more of the territory. They had some corners. They weren't really peppering our goal with shots bar, you know, the one that hit the crossbar and the post after Zinchenko gave it away. But in terms of their momentum or our inability to halt their momentum, what did you make of the way Arteta reacted or didn't react with what he had on the bench?
I do think that the second half drifted from us, you know, and I think it was allowed to drift. There could have been more maybe that the manager could do to change things up. It was very clear that it was going against us, and it felt like whatever changes he made did little to kind of stem that tide. From a Villa perspective, I think they just grew and grew in confidence. You know, chatting to the Athletic's Villa correspondent before the game, Jacob Tanswell, and he was saying he felt Villa expectations going into this were pretty low, you know, without the two defensive midfield players you mentioned. You know, they'd shown signs of tiring, I think, in recent weeks. And I basically think the longer they stayed in the game, the stronger they got. And it was interesting afterwards, Unai Emery was asked, so what did you do, Unai, at half-time? And normally a manager would, you know, relish the opportunity to tell you about the tinkering they did or the little changes they made. It's basically an opportunity to show off. He sort of shrugged his shoulders and said, nothing. You know, we kept playing our game. We gained a bit more possession. We gained a bit more territory. And I just think, you know, we wilted a little bit, really, as they grew stronger.
But does that not then make it more frustrating or more, trying to think of the word here, like, the structural changes Arteta made were Odegaard and Jesus coming off at 80 minutes.
Yeah.
For Smith Rowe and Jorginho. Like, you know, where, for example, if midfield was an area in which we weren't really dominating the way you would expect to dominate at home against a team like Villa with the absences that they have, where was the effort or the endeavour to try and change something in that area of the pitch? That's what I find quite strange. You know, when you've got Thomas Partey on the bench, when you've got Jorginho on the bench, mm-hmm. where you could, let's say, sacrifice Gabriel Jesus a bit earlier, put Havertz back up top, bring Partey or Jorginho on, put Rice a little bit further forward, and try and address the Villa, if you want to call it dominance, in that way. I found it very odd that, well, look, Partey didn't get off the bench. Jorginho, you can understand, played in midweek. You can understand maybe why he didn't start, but, like, can he do half an hour here? I just, like, if our performance in the second half was static, so was Arteta's reaction from the bench.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I wonder if he felt, because he obviously left Zinchenko on for 87 minutes. I wonder if he felt that he could kind of help win that midfield battle. It didn't really transpire in that way in the second half. I would have liked to see Jorginho or Partey on earlier. I would have liked to see Havertz, you know, moving up top to provide us with an outlet. But, you know, I really felt in that second half, I mean, I thought we looked quite listless, to be honest with you. I think we had four shots. in the second half, none of which really provoked any great danger. There was a Gabriel Jesus one from the edge of the box.
Yeah, easy save, relatively easy save for
it. Not quite a straightforward save. I think that was sort of it, really, in terms of us going close. And yeah, that, they just seemed to get a real foothold in the game. You know, I think Zaniolo was quite impressive for them. They had that threat on the other flank with Diaby and then Leon Bailey, who's probably one of the Premier League's better substitutes, always seems to make an impact. And to be honest, by the time it got to sort of 79, 80 minutes and that double change was made, Smith Rowe and Jorginho came on, I have to be honest and say I was already of a mind where I was like, this does not look like a game Arsenal can win.
Yeah.
And I'd probably be an exaggeration to say I'd made peace with that, but I certainly, in the back of my mind, was like, well, don't lose. You know, this point could be important.
Yeah.
So you can imagine how thrilled I was when we then conceded two goals.
Well, look, you know, some of the things, you know, when you're having a day like that, when you're playing below your best level in the second half, I think you just need to be, I think maybe Declan Rice said this afterwards in a way, he said something like, you know, if it's a game you're not going to win, recognize that at 75 minutes and make sure you don't lose. But, you know, part of that is how secure you are as a team. I mentioned that Tielemans shot that hit the bar and the post. When Zinchenko, you know, we'd won the ball back from a corner. We defended the corner and had possession. And, you know, this is where you want an experienced player to, you know, make a pass. I get he was trying to make something happen on the break, maybe. But the sort of carelessness and stupidity of what he did on the edge of the box there to hand that chance to Tielemans. I mean, we're lucky. It hit the bar, hit the post, and Raya was completely beaten by it. And I think, you know, at this level, you know, in a game like this, in this context with so much at stake, that's a really poor moment from Zinchenko. And it just sort of contributed to our back-footedness, if you like.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, yeah, I'm just looking at what Declan Rice said now. If you can't win games of football, don't lose. Look up at the clock with 15 to go and it's 0-0.
Mm.
If you aren't going to win, then you take a point, especially in these situations. But then he said, this is Arsenal and you feel the pressure that you have to win these matches. And I wonder as well, the nature of this title race, how close it is between three teams, the nature of the opposition in Manchester City, the players probably felt they did have to win, you know, and maybe their minds weren't so much on the security at the back and the keeping the clean sheet. Because, yeah, I think you're right. You know, we might well have looked at that Tielemans chance and that Watkins chance and thought, wow, we've been a bit lucky there. Maybe we just kind of what we have, we hold. Yeah, you know, I do think this morning if we were looking at it and it was a draw, I think we'd be frustrated, but I don't think we'd be as despondent as we are.
No, and look, it's the timing of the goals, of course, and like we didn't have a good second half, but you get to 84 minutes and you think, okay, well, maybe we can get a set piece, maybe we can nick it, maybe we can find, you know, that moment that might give you the 3 points, but the goals we conceded were just so frustrating, really, because I think they're, like most goals, I think they're preventable, you know? What do you make of the first one? I mean, they had a corner, we got it clear, they put it back in. It's a speculative ball into the box from Luka Dean, I think it is. And I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, can Havertz do more to stop it? Can Raya do more at his front post? Is Saliba caught on his heels a little bit? Declan Rice is asleep, unfortunately. I think we all really love Declan Rice and what he's brought to this team, but that was a moment where, you know, if another player had been in that position and switched off in that way to let Bailey in to score the goal, then, you know, they'd be getting a fair amount of criticism. So it's just one of those where there's a collection of things, and it just felt like a dagger blow, didn't it? Because if there was the vague possibility that we might nick a goal to win the game 1-0, it didn't feel in any way possible or feasible that we might get two goals to win it 2-1.
No, I think that's right. I mean, there's some odd things in the build up to this goal. I know it's a corner and it's cleared. There's a clip of Zinchenko on social media that's been doing the rounds of him running backwards towards his own goal and sort of skewing the offside trap, shall we say, in a different instance in the second half. But just watching back this first goal, even then, he kind of does a similar thing.
Oh,
where
he does, yeah. I'm rewatching it, yeah.
So, like, the defence go to hold their line and he actually drops back 2 or 3 yards, and it doesn't directly lead to the goal, but I think it does sort of enable Villa to potentially play through that line in the next phase, and just means we're just a little bit more ragged than you would ideally like. Because, Luca Dean gets played in, but actually the rest of the guys are trying to hold an offside line. Now, whether that would have held, I don't know. Then the cross comes in, and it's just one of those weird ones where it almost feels like everybody thinks someone else is going to get to it.
Yeah, Rice isn't aware that Bailey is behind him.
No. And Saliba, Gabriel and Raya are all within about a yard of the ball, but none of them actually get anything on it. Raya's very committed at his near post, as he tends to be. And Bailey taps it in. So, yeah, a horrible goal, actually. Not a good goal for us to concede. Mm-mm. Really sloppy. And obviously the timing of it, absolutely brutal.
Yeah, the 84th minute coming up on the 85th minute. The second goal, Jorginho was on to give us some security in possession and maybe to be able to produce a pass into the final third, which he is more than capable of, but he gave it away.
Yeah.
Watkins runs through. I think there is just a touch of good fortune about the finish here, because
takes a little nick, doesn't
takes
it?
Takes a nick off Emile Smith Rowe, which lifts it over Raya. Maybe he would have done that anyway, and you know, you can make the argument that if you give Ollie Watkins, in the form he's in this season, that much space to run into, it's only going to end one way. But just carelessness, or just giving the ball away in the final third and getting caught out by one pass, because we've obviously pushed forward to try and get an equaliser.
Yeah, we had a corner, didn't we? And centre-backs came up for it. Emile Smith-Rowe was back defending on the halfway line. I guess that isn't who you'd want in a 1v1.
Should he have taken him down? Should he have just hacked him down? I mean, look, I've seen people talk about that, but I think he had to
catch him first.
Yeah.
Maybe. If there's a player who's maybe, it's understandable they don't necessarily have those instincts, it might be Emile Smith Rowe, in that, you know, I just don't think that's a situation he's even found himself in too many times in his career. And Jorginho's pass is cut out. There's that sort of hurriedness that creeps in when you're chasing it. And
I was desperate for, VAR, offside flag, whatever it was. And then you see that Watkins has made the run from inside his own half. So.
Oh, has he? Right. Yeah. So, like I said, painful one. The noise from the Villa fans was something else. I've got to tell you, they absolutely loved it. Stark contrast to midweek against Bayern, the silence. And, there was a lot of grievances and bit of anger as well, frustration from the Arsenal fans, who, you know, have been incredibly united and incredibly supportive. But I feel like it's the opportunity missed, isn't it? The Liverpool result really kind of colours the complexion of this result too.
I think I think that is a factor in how people responded or felt or feel right now, that the door, look, not the door was open, but, you know, when one of your title rivals drops points, you're thinking, okay, it's even more important now that we take advantage.
Yeah, I think it's a hell of a swing in the space of a couple of hours in terms of how people were feeling. So there we go. I mean, it was a game of two halves. I think the cliche is right in this instance. And the difference is that in their half, Villa took their chances.
Mm.
And we didn't really have an answer for it. Like you say, you know, whether it's on the manager or on the players, it just felt like they had our number a bit in that half and we weren't able to change it up.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that for me is maybe the most worrying aspect is that, you know, you could be 20 minutes into that second half, or you could see what way it was panning out. And the fact that we weren't able to either readjust with the players we had on the pitch or address that with some of the players that we had on the bench, that's a worry. Like, I accept there are going to be halves of football where you are outplayed. There's going to be games where, you know, you're up against a good team and Villa are a good team. There's no question about that.
They're going to be a Champions League team next season. Yeah, so this isn't quite the same as us not being Fulham home and away, you know?
No.
They're a decent side.
They are a decent side. But, yeah, you know, I just found that part of it a little bit annoying or frustrating or worrying that we didn't react quickly enough. We didn't react well enough. I'm not sure the changes were the right changes. And look, a manager can get things wrong. A manager can pick the wrong team. He can make the wrong changes. He can make the wrong substitutions. They all do it, you know, all of them. So it's not, I think, unique to Mikel Arteta in any way. It's just that the timing of this in the... It is, to some extent, if the Villa goals were the 84th minute daggers, this is sort of like the 84th minute of the season as well, isn't it? That
you don't
have the room or the time to respond. And it is, again, I'll come back to this. We're 2 points behind City. There are 6 games to go. There's a lot to play for. Anything can happen. Like, I think we were down for the count, but we haven't been knocked out yet. But it's very hard to rationalize that or come to terms with that, because you sort of know deep down in your soul what Manchester City are going to do from here on in.
Yeah, and of course we spoke about the Liverpool result affecting the mood. Maybe the City result too. I mean, we all expected them to beat Luton, but 5-1, you know, 8 into our goal difference advantage pretty significantly, especially when you add the defeat to Villa. So the picture does look rather ominous at this point in time.
Mm.
But maybe Dubai is the answer. It'd probably be cheaper than some of the direct flights to Munich. just squeeze just a day in Dubai.
Yeah. Get one in there. I mean, what do you make of what Arteta said afterwards and the message that he sent about what we need to do now? He sort of said, like, you know, if one result is going to derail the team, then we're not strong enough, and that's simple. And that will play out in front of our eyes over the coming weeks. You know, we hope that we are strong enough to react to one defeat, because, you know, what is more representative of this team? Is it the 11 games unbeaten or the one game that we've lost? I think it is the 11 games unbeaten, and the way that we have managed games, and the way that we have dominated, and the way that we have scored goals, and the way we have been defensively parsimonious and, you know, dug in, and the collective effort, which, you know, I think to a large extent was still there yesterday, because you could see players like Trossard, like Havertz, like Saka, like Jesus, coming back and doing their defensive duty. You know, that was present in the performance. The difference was that we weren't able to find the goals at the moments in the game where I think they would have made a big difference. But how we react now, I mean, this has to be like, okay, that was bad. It's down. We're all downhearted. We're all disappointed. We're all frustrated. But you've got to, like, put that in a box and put it behind you straight away, because we've got a Champions League quarterfinal, and we do have 6 more games in the Premier League with 18 points that could leave us on How many points do we have at the moment? I have to look at the table.
71.
71. So, you know, you end up with 89 if you win all those games and you hope for a miracle somewhere along the way that somebody can do something against Manchester City. And you know, that has to be the way that this team reacts. It's maybe more difficult to convince fans that that is, you know, well, that's not something we can control anyway, you know. But Arteta has to lift these players and lift the mood and find the zip in their legs again that was missing in that second half yesterday.
I think so. I think as well, when we talk about that run of good results and maybe a little dip at this point now, I think we have to respect the fixture list and respect the schedule as well. You know, we are in a period now where we have hard games and we have lots of hard games. It's not playing Nottingham Forest 1 week and then 7 days later, Sheffield United and, you know, Burnley. I forget the specifics, but we had a kind run that we absolutely took full advantage of. But now we're in a run where in the space of, what, a couple of weeks, we've played Man City, Bayern Munich, Aston Villa, who I think are a good side, beat City this season, beat us earlier this season. We've got Munich again on Tuesday. You know, I mentioned Spurs and United to come. This is a stickier, more difficult part of the season. And I think maintaining consistency during that is much harder. And yeah, it's funny you say, like, we hope for a miracle that City might drop points somewhere. To be honest, looking at our games, I think it's more of a miracle if we can win them all.
Well, I think that's a fair point. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, that was always going to be the challenge for us. It wasn't so much about what Man City did. And of course, if we'd won yesterday, it would be in our hands. But I still think we have some very, very difficult games. You know, after Munich, it's Wolves away. Then you've got Chelsea, who, you know, regardless of what sort of a season they have, are always a dangerous team to play against. You've got Spurs away. You've got Manchester United away. You know, those are really, really tough games anyway. You know, even if you remain perfect, the possibility that you're going to come up against the wrong opponent at the wrong time, you know, was there throughout our run-in, but whatever little margin for error is now gone. So, yeah.
And Mikel, I think he's right to say you can't let one game derail you. And I don't think the draw against Bayern Munich was, you know, a bad result, particularly in the context of having been behind. But, you know, that game at the Allianz Arena feels absolutely massive now, because if Arsenal don't get a result there, you know, it's easy to see how the narrative becomes, well, it's three games, you know, where they've not got what they wanted. And suddenly their chances of finishing the season on a high are dramatically reduced. So, you know, these things can snowball pretty quickly. And I just think, what was already a huge game feels even bigger today.
I mean, is it a case of, you know, when things are going great, people tend to see everything in the garden as rosy, and the minute something goes wrong, it's all falling apart. It's hard to keep perspective. And look, everyone is entitled to their own disappointment this morning, because I think, like I said to you yesterday, remember you saying, like, can you really be Premier League champions if you don't beat Manchester City? And I think it's a great point. But can you also be Premier League champions if you lose twice in one season to Aston Villa? And again, you know, I think Villa are a good side, and it's not necessarily that, but it is a big blow at 6 points. Like I said, everybody is quite entitled to feel disappointed and dismayed today, because ultimately I think what we have seen, despite what you said about the fixture list, I think this is an Arsenal team that, if it can beat Manchester City, if it can go to City away and stop them from having a meaningful shot on goal, if it can beat Liverpool having drawn with Liverpool at Anfield, it is a team that's capable of beating Aston Villa at least once. It's a team that's capable of beating West Ham and beating Fulham. And these are the vagaries of football that we all understand. But you can also completely understand why people are now, you know, downhearted and fearing the worst.
Yeah. I mean, we've lost too many games. If you look at the league table, City and Liverpool have lost 3 times each this season and we've lost 5. And there's plenty of those games that, you know, we could argue we shouldn't have lost for different reasons.
Yeah.
Think of St. James's Park, or think of kind of almost the absurdity of the West Ham game with our inability to put the ball in the net. But, you know, if we lose one or two more, you really do end up getting to a figure that you don't associate with Premier League champions in this era.
Yes. Isn't there one where you... Like, no team has ever lost more than six games and won the title. Right. And I think, you know, in this current era where City barely lose any games at all, I think, you know, if you lose, I mean, I think 5 is probably the outer limit. There's no way you can win it losing more than 5 games. So we've got to be perfect.
Certainly when you're up against what we're up against now, yeah.
We've got to be perfect and we've got to hope that...
7 is the record. Seven is Blackburn Rovers in 1995.
Well, that tells you a lot, doesn't it? 1995. Yeah.
So since 1995, it's not been able to be more than 6. So like you said, no margin for error now at all.
At all. And focus has to be on midweek and on Bayern Munich and what we're going to be able to do in the Champions League quarterfinal. Right. Anything else? First half on that game?
Thanks to the women for at least getting a good result last night.
I turned that on as I was doing my post-game stuff for Arseblog News. I turned that on and was tip-tapping away and working away and enjoyed the goals.
Yeah.
Enjoyed Alessio Russo's 2 goals. They were very good.
But other than that, I mean, not really. Like you said, I do think Zinchenko is a big talking point today, but you said you had a question about him. So maybe let's leave that for part 2.
Let's leave that for part 2. Then we will come back with your questions and more right after this.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arseblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arseblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/arseblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer the questions that you sent to us on Twitter at GunnarBlog and at ArsBlog, also on the ArsBlog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an ArsBlog member on Patreon. And just to remind you that if you want to sign up to our Patreon this month, you get instant access to all the content that we produce there. We'll have a Bayern Munich preview podcast, for example. But every penny of our Patreon revenue for the month of April is going to help children around the world affected by war, famine, conflict, disease. We're donating every penny to UNICEF. So if you want to help, if you want to sign up, get all that great content and help a great cause, you can do it at patreon.com/arsblog. Right. I have Zinchenko questions.
Go on.
There were a lot of Zinchenko questions, it's fair to say, across Twitter and Discord. One from both. Wise Marklar says, was that a performance from Zinchenko yesterday so far below the standards that it could lead to a summer sale? And OP on Twitter, who's at Bald Trev, he says, Zinchenko stay or Zinchenko go this summer?
Wow. Well, I do feel that yesterday was a bit of a breaking point. Alfie Parsons said, do you think yesterday was a breaking point with Zinchenko and the fans? I mean, I'm always hesitant to say a player was booed off because you never know quite how many people are booing and how many aren't. But let's just say there were boos yesterday when he was withdrawn. Certainly around me in the press box. So what's that? The West Stand. Supporters were not happy with him. And it does feel like the relationship between the player and the fans is not great right now. Social media is a mess if you search for Zinchenko. And some of that has nothing to do with football. You know, I do not approve of that at all. But there are a lot of footballing reasons to talk about him and his role. And it's tricky because I like a lot about him. Like, I really do admire his ability and his personality. His personality to play, you know, his willingness to get on the ball and take risks. I really do admire that. But I also feels increasingly like he's kind of out of step with this team. Like, in a season in which there's been so much emphasis on reducing risk, he is a player who inherently carries a certain degree of risk.
Yeah.
And I feel like it may be the next step of our evolution to move beyond that.
Yeah.
I mean, some people feel we already have moved beyond it. You know, there are a lot of people who don't want to see him play, who want to see a Jakub Kivior or Takehiro Tomiyasu. So, yeah, what did you make of yesterday and the picture more broadly around Zinchenko?
I thought your point yesterday, you just made it there and you made it on your On the Whistle video, was really telling that to a very large extent, as much as he possibly can, Arteta has sought to eliminate risk from his players and the team in general. But Zinchenko is a risk machine, and sometimes it's really positive and other times it's not. You know, I sort of feel like the tactical benefit of him was obvious to Arsenal. And I think it would be unfair not to acknowledge that he had a very big impact and a very positive impact for quite a while. But for a while now, I felt like that was waning. You talked about the fans. You know, I mentioned it after the Bayern game that around me, there was a lot of, I'm going to say, nervousness about Zinchenko the other night. I'm not going to say, look, people say things and shout things in the heat and the moment of football matches, but the primary reaction to Zinchenko on Tuesday night in the Bayern game was one of nervousness. It wasn't anger and it wasn't spite and it wasn't boos or jeers. It was just he was making people nervous, and I have to say he made me nervous. I think there were elements of that in his second half performance yesterday. First half, I think he was all right. You know, we did pretty good or pretty well in that first half, and he played some nice passes at times. But in the second half, you know, that moment with Tielemans, there were too many moments where, like the clip that you mentioned in that that was doing the rounds, where basically you have White, Saliba and Gabriel holding a high line and Zinchenko is dropping deeper and deeper. And actually what he needs to do is step back into the line and he will catch, I think it's Leon Bailey at that point, he'll catch him offside, but he just keeps dropping deeper and deeper and deeper. And that unsettles your defense. It invites more pressure. I think he is... hesitate to use the word afraid, but I think he's so cognizant of the ball over the top at this point that he's not doing what a defender should do, you know, what a competent defender should do in that position. I read your piece in The Athletic today as well. Where I have the most concern is not necessarily the defending, because I'm sort of at peace with who he is and what he does in that regard. Yeah. But the benefits of what he can bring to the team are gone pretty much in possession. I think, you know, he's too slow, too many touches. The tactical shift of Zinchenko inverting into midfield, I think, is one that opposition teams have figured out. I think they've figured it out. And it doesn't bring us the same positives that it used to. And therefore doesn't offset the flaws in his game. So, you know, I'm looking at him, and look, I said this the other day, so I don't want to repeat myself too much. I think Arsenal need a left back in the summer. I think they need to go out and buy, in inverted commas, a proper left back. And I don't just mean someone who's going to run up and down the wing and be an old school fullback. I think they need the right player for this team for that position, and we don't have it. And if I think about how Mikel Arteta is dealt with the wrong word, but I think he has demonstrated a ruthlessness with other players that he now needs to demonstrate with Zinchenko.
I think he will, to be honest with you. I think that's where this is headed. I mean, I wrote it this morning, but you know, I hear that Arsenal do want a left back in the summer, which is quite something.
Good.
They currently own six.
Yeah.
But that tells its own story in a way. They haven't quite got the right player for that position. I suppose it was worth mentioning that way back when, you know, it was Lisandro Martinez that they wanted, someone who was more of a traditional defender. And I think they need someone who's got more of an all-round game.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're absolutely right. I think Zinchenko was an innovation. I think it took teams a long time to get to grips with that. And I think we can probably say they now have. I also think that we owe it to Zinchenko to say he's probably in bad form as well. He's probably a guy who's lost form, and that happens. Like, it's not to say his talent is redundant and that he will never come again, but I think he's in a bit of a rut at the point in time.
I mean, is that not in part due to the fact that he has these ongoing fitness issues where he plays a lot of games, gets an injury, has to be replaced in the team, and when he was replaced by Kivior, you know, the team was doing well, so you stick with that, so he loses the rhythm and the fluency, and I think that's part of the Zinchenko experience as well that you have to take into account when you're thinking about, you know, what you do in the summer and how you build your squad.
And I'm afraid to say it's also part of the Tomiyasu experience.
Yes.
You know, when you look at the left-back options, obviously Tierney and Tavares, they're out on loan. I don't think anything's going to happen with them. But Kivior would rather be a centre-back. Tomiyasu would probably rather be a centre-back or a right-back. Timber would probably rather be a centre-back or a right-back. Zinchenko would probably rather be a number 10. Mm. Like, we need a left-back, a true left-back. And that doesn't mean it's got to be Nigel Winterburn. You know what I mean? It can be a modern fullback.
Exactly. Who's
got a very well-rounded game. But that is something Arsenal need. It's something they know they need. And hopefully it will be attended to in the summer. And with Zinchenko's contract position being what it is, 2 years to go, you know, sign or sell. I think if there's a buyer, there's a decent chance that he could go. And I think there would be a buyer. I think he's a gifted enough player that I think, you know, some pretty big clubs would be interested potentially. And I just feel that, yeah, maybe, you know, it's the next phase of our evolution. But I think that in itself is a fascinating topic. I mean, the speed at which the team is potentially moving on from players is quite dramatic, isn't it? If you think of what we paid for Aaron Ramsdale or Zinchenko or Gabriel Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to mention him, yeah.
You know, and then a couple of seasons later, we're maybe saying, oh, we've maybe moved beyond that.
Yeah.
There's kind of good and bad in that, isn't there?
Because
in a way, it's like, great, look how fast, how rapidly we're evolving. You know, we're right at the competitive edge. On the other hand, you don't really want to be paying sort of £50 million fees or £30 million fees for guys who, within a couple of years, we're all thinking might be on the scrap heap.
No, I agree. Yeah, it's hard to keep up with the pace of that development, if you like. I mean,
my final thing on Zinchenko is just that I find it sort of continually compelling that this manager who, I don't know if everyone will agree with this, but I would say is fundamentally quite risk averse, finds himself sort of inextricably drawn to this player who, you know, as we say, comes with this element of risk. Maybe that's just a lack of alternative options. You know, maybe if Julian Timber had been fit this season, this wouldn't be a talking point. But he does find something very alluring about Zinchenko. I just feel like the balance, watching Arteta on the sidelines yesterday, I feel like the balance is perhaps shifting at this point in time.
And I don't think, I know this is a small thing, and you know, when we talk about the reaction of the fans, I don't think he helped himself in the first half yesterday by putting the ball out of play.
Listen, 100% that was a factor in how he was received by the fans.
Look, it could be Zinchenko, it could be Ben White, who I love, it could be any of the players that I love, and if they do that, it drives me absolutely mad. And I think, you know, the mindset that you need to have, you know, when the stakes are so high, when the margins are so tight, if two Aston Villa players run into each other and one of them is down on the ground pretending to be injured, you do not let them off the hook in that way. I'm not saying we would have scored, you know, probably wouldn't have, but it just sort of speaks to the mindset that you need to have as potential Premier League champions. It's like, I'm going to step on you until I get what I want, and I'm just not going to let you off the hook by putting the ball out of play.
Yeah, I was, you know, I think people were infuriated by that, and I completely understand why. I mean, to slightly move the question on, or the subject on, Dean on Twitter, DJ Stannis, said, "Morning, gents. What does Mikel do with left back for the rest of the season? I mean, what now?
It's a great question. I mean, I think if it were me, I would go with Tomiyasu.
Am I right in saying that he's not yet started since he came back? He's certainly not started a Premier League game.
No, I mean,
is he not ready? Like, what's maybe going not. On there?
I don't know. If he's ready, I'd start him on Wednesday. I just don't think after that display yesterday you can start Zinchenko in a game of that magnitude on Wednesday night. I just don't, like, unless there's literally no other option, there's no way he can start that game. So it could be Kivior, but we saw in the first game that Kivior struggled a bit in that position against Bayern. And to me, the best option we have, if he's fit enough to play, you know, in the current context of where we are, is Tomiyasu.
I agree, but I just feel like it concerns me that he's not started until now.
Yeah.
What's happening there, you know,
yeah,
what's underlying that? Because I think logically, that's the one that makes most sense. I need, or either that, or I need some Twitter ITK to tell me that Jurrien Timber's suddenly available.
I mean, look, let's be realistic about that as well.
Yeah,
you know, I think if we see Jurrien Timber back this season, it will be a significant psychological step for him, and I think an important one, and I hope that we see it. But I can't think of any example where a player who's been out with that injury and been out for that long comes back in the last 3 weeks, 4 weeks of the season and is anywhere near close to being the player that everyone expects them to be. Because you need time, you need games, you need rhythm, you need all of that to find your form, you know? So I think if he's an option, he might be an option, you know? But if Jurrien Timber comes back and starts a couple of games and is rusty and makes a mistake or two, well, I hope people are willing to accept that, because you have to look at that in the context of his season, not our season.
Yeah, I would pick Tomiyasu in the Allianz Arena. I have to be totally honest, though, and say, and until now, I've refused to be surprised when Arteta perhaps picks Zinchenko, just because, as I say, for so long, I think he's found him irresistible. And he's been prepared to kind of indulge some of his flaws. I do have the sense that's shifting. I guess we might find out on Wednesday. You made a point there about players coming back from injury and not necessarily being at their best, which I think is, feels very pertinent, to be honest, to Arsenal right now. But kind of along those lines, Dollop Trollop on Twitter said, what's happened to £30 million Fabio Vieira? His injection of pace and verve would be quite useful now. Is he not fit to even make a cameo? He's been on the bench for a little while with no minutes.
I mean, your guess is as good as mine.
It does feel like we've got all these players back, but we haven't actually got any of them back.
Yeah, like Tomiyasu has had a few minutes here and there. Partey's had a couple of minutes here and there. Vieira has barely played at all. Look, you know me. I love Emile Smith Rowe. I think he, you know, I've got a question about him now as well. But it strikes me that if Martin Odegaard has to come off, that Fabio Vieira is the closest analogue we have for him. And I'm not saying he's anywhere near as good as Martin Odegaard, because I don't think he is. So it was slightly surprising that we took Odegaard off and didn't try and put somebody who can do at least an approximation of what he does, because Smith Rowe is a very different kind of player who didn't really get into the game yesterday, and you know, neither did Jorginho. So I don't know.
Odegaard was feeling something, according to Mikel. So.
Sad that none of the cunts ahead of him could fucking score a goal, I would say. That's what he was feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, it must have been it.
Yeah.
Yes, Fabio Vieira. I mean, I'm not sure about injection of pace from him, but, you know, there was a time where his technical quality felt like could be a difference maker in certain games. I just feel like his Arsenal career has been so stop-start as to have never really started.
Mm.
And if you were drawing up your list of possible departures this summer, I think, you know, at least in pencil, perhaps not pen, but in pencil, you'd have to put Fabio Vieira as a contender.
As a possible. I mean, I think the only saving grace for him might be that there are quite a number of other players who should probably go first.
They're in pen.
Permanent marker. I mean, we had a question here from Naf Torrance at Naftor on Twitter. He says, we've talked a lot about the need for a nine, a fast winger, left back, but is it Odegaard we are most reliant on and most miss when he's not there? Is someone to work alongside or cover for him one of the biggest needs of this summer? And is that realistic?
Well, listen, I'd love an Arsenal team with two Martin Odegaards in it.
Yeah, I'd like two Martin Odegaards more than I'd like two Kai Havertzes and two Declan Rices. I think one of each of those is perfect, but like another Odegaard would be...
I hope the money from the sober reality training ground sponsorship is going into some sort of cloning project, though. that seems to be the answer. Yes, I think we are most reliant on him because I think the replacements are so far away from what he produces. Arteta's did say he was in some pain at the end of the game. Let's hope it's nothing significant because we'll desperately need him over the next few weeks. As regards to the summer, I think you can make a pretty convincing case. Opinions may vary, but I think you can make a strong case that the need for a midfield player now supersedes the need for a striker. I mean, you know, in an ideal world, you do both.
Yeah.
And a left back and probably, in all likelihood, at least one goalkeeper.
Yeah.
It's amazing how good a season you can have and how much work you can feel you have to do in the summer.
Of course. And, of course, you know, there's also an element of how much you can realistically do. You know, yeah. I think you could make a good case for a lot of players going, a lot of players coming in, but how much of that is realistically possible given, you know, budgets and consistency that you need and all that, you know? Mm. What about this one from non-flying Dutchman who says, I hope my question isn't too reactionary. He says, was or should that be the last time we see Emile Smith Rowe in an Arsenal shirt? His performance reminded me of when he came on against Newcastle. Just that day, we happened to be out of sight when he was introduced. He came on for our captain and best player on the day and didn't show the kind of effort or enthusiasm I was hoping for. He lost a header against a smaller player in the build-up to the first goal, didn't win any duels, and didn't create anything going forward. I love Smith Rowe, and I thought he would have a great career here, but now he's in the same category as Nelson and Nketiah as academy players that need to be moved on.
Is that too reactionary? I think that we all sort of instinctively sense where this is headed. I'm not sure it will be the last time. I mean, you never know. There'll be games between now and the end of the season where Arteta might use him. The fact he picked him, was it against Luton the other day from the start? Shows that I think he considers him part of the group for this run-in period. But in the longer term, I find it very difficult to see him having a place at Arsenal. I think that criticism, I'm trying to sort of be as objective as I can, because obviously I like Smith Rowe and he's an academy player. I think that his running style is not the most dynamic. And I can see that you know, could read or come off as lazy. I don't think there's any lack of effort on his part. I think he wants to be part of the Arsenal team. I think basically what we're looking at is a player who's been forced into playing in a different position by the emergence of other players like Martinelli and Trossard. And ultimately, I just don't think he's shown that he's massively suited to it. Like, to me, I don't think he's quite good enough a two-way player to do that Odegaard role. I think it's as simple as that, really, and I don't see him getting into the team in the more attacking parts of the pitch for Arsenal, so I think he probably will go. What do you think?
I mean, I don't think it should be the last time we see him in an Arsenal show. I don't think his performance yesterday was so bad that it's like, well, that's it, now you're done.
No.
It was a little bit disappointing that he couldn't get into the game. But then, as we said, I think that that's much more on the manager and the timing of those subs as anything else. You know, he comes on and within 4 minutes, Villa are 1-0 up and it changes the complexion of the game. I mean, it would have been nice to see a bit more from him. I think he might be a player who we turn to from the bench if we need to do something in a game because, you know, where are the other candidates on that bench? Fabio Vieira, we've talked about. Reece Nelson, not for me. As someone who can come on and really change a game, and I know he had that moment against Bournemouth, but, you know, that's a one-off in his career. Eddie, whose minutes have just completely dried up as the season has gone on. You know, where are the attacking players that can come off the bench or maybe help us change the momentum? So he's one of those, and he might be, but I do think, you know, if there was a triple Haylen departure this summer with Smith Rowe, Nelson and Nketiah, I wouldn't be even slightly surprised.
No. I mean, like you said, the only thing that might prohibit that is just that question of how much can you do in one summer, you know? And
yeah.
I think we always draw up big lists of potential departures, and come the end of deadline day, you know, there's usually at least a couple of them who are still with the squad. But in principle, I do agree with you. A couple of questions here about the home form. So Josh Bennett on the Discord said, "Hi both. This team has been rightly praised this season for keeping 5 consecutive clean sheets away from home. Meanwhile, at home, we've kept 5 clean sheets all season and are only the 5th highest goal scorers. Last season, we were the 2nd highest scorers at home, but conceded more than 12 others, level with Spurs. Do you think home away advantage is overrated, or is this an area we need to talk about more? What do you think the issue could be?" And Daniel Constable chimed in, "Very badly, morning, gents. Am I the only one really concerned with our home performances? I have more fear with these than going into away games. What do you think the root cause could be?"
Oh, I mean, I wish I knew properly. This is a question that pops up almost every season, isn't it? That why are we so good away and we're not as good at home? Or why are we so good at home and we can't translate that to away? I mean, you could make...
I've got to be honest and say, I don't know. I don't understand why that's happening.
I don't either. I mean, you could make an argument about levels of expectation at home. You know, is there a bit more pressure because you're trying to entertain 57,000 Arsenal fans as opposed to 3,000 traveling fans?
Do you expect to win more?
Yeah, therefore? I think there is a level of expectation that comes with home games.
So maybe you were a bit less conservative than you might be in an away game, or a bit less defensively minded.
Possible, you're feel like the onus, exactly. The onus is on you to go out and not just win, but to perform and to play and to dominate and to play the game in the opposition half. So it's possible that by doing that, you leave yourself a bit more vulnerable to counterattacks, which, you know, has been a bit of a flaw. But I don't know. I wish I had the solution You know, we'd obviously be better off with it, but I just think it's just one of those things with football that is often the case, that you have these differences between home and away form that aren't really explicable beyond anything that you can come up with on a surface level, like we've just done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if I had to put a rational explanation to it, that would be it, that we, in away games, sort of intuitively play in a more structured, conservative manner, and that in some way that plays to the strengths of the team and makes us a bit more robust.
Mm.
But it's a reach and a guess, to be honest with you.
What about this? We had a couple of questions about Leandro Trossard. Arsenal Addict at Arsenal Addict says, "Trossard is great in Europe and as a sub, but not so effective as a domestic starter. Should that be his role going forward?" And Tayo, our good friend Tayo, said, "Did you find yourself wishing Arteta could somehow have replaced Trossard with Trossard?" less glibly, "With your manager hat on, do you start him on Wednesday?"
I don't know. I mean, I think he's just a player that he can sort of be a bit frustrating and a bit in and out, but does have tremendous end product. And had his finish been better yesterday, would have walked away from another game with a goal. He reminds me a little bit of sort of Andreas Schärvin almost, you know, in that he can be quite peripheral at times, or, you know, a little bit grating in his performance, but has the knack of making the difference. I don't know if there's quite enough correlation there between him starting and not performing and coming on and performing. What I would say is I think his best performances for Arsenal have come when playing through the middle. I think he has flourished there and the team has really typically performed well with him in that position. I think when he starts on the left, he just doesn't quite have the threat in behind to replicate what Gabriel Martinelli can offer us and what I think ideally we would have in a player on that flank. So I wonder if it's as much that as anything. I think when he starts as the sort of false nine, he tends to do all right.
I think it is one of those things where he is maybe our best impact player from the bench.
Yeah, wouldn't disagree with that.
But by making those impacts from the bench, he sort of forces himself into the starting lineup. And it's the circle of Trossard, if you like, where I agree with you. I think sometimes he is best down the middle. And certainly he is most dangerous in central areas. Like, we've spoken about him at left eight before, and I'm not necessarily convinced he's a real option there. But even out wide, you know, games can pass him by a little bit. And I think maybe yesterday was one of those, bar that moment, where he wasn't brilliant. But then you're looking at the bench and saying, well, who am I gonna bring on here? And, of course, Martinelli's the obvious one. I was surprised, I have to say, that Martinelli didn't start this game. Because I, in my own mind anyway, after the impact he made against Bayern on Tuesday, I had sort of talked myself into the idea that Trossard was going to start against Bayern.
So where are we in the Trossard cycle right now?
I don't know where we are in the circle of Trossard. He's played himself back out of the team to the point where Mikel Arteta might think, right, well, if I need somebody to come on and do something on Wednesday night, who's my best bet? And it's Trossard again. Come on, he'll score a couple of goals to win the game for us late on, and then he'll start first leg of the semi-final against Real Madrid, and the game will, you know, pass him by, and he'll be back on the bench.
Yeah,
and so
wax
it goes
on, wax off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I said it is a sort of delicate one for a manager, isn't it? It's hard when you've got a player who comes off the bench and makes an impact. You know, they probably come and knock on your door and say, "What more do I need to do?" But I think that's part of being a top manager. You need to sort of tell Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, sorry, mate, that's your role. It's difficult to do and difficult to keep players happy with that, but I think that's the game.
Yeah.
What do you think of this? Everyone's up for debate now. So Zenode on Discord said, a craptacular evening, gents. Does goalkeeper need to be added to the shopping list in the summer? Right, hasn't been tested much this year, but when he has, results aren't great. I felt he could have done more on the Watkins chip and the Gnabry goal, not to mention several other issues. There has to be a top team. Don't we need a top keeper where Raya is just statistically slightly above average but behind a great defence?
Yeah, let's just buy a goalkeeper every year. Just once a year. It's the great Arsenal goalkeeper hunt. We're buying
a
new goalkeeper.
We could loan one. We'd make Raya permanent and then we loan another one and put him in above Raya. I don't know. Yeah, I'm with you. I think obviously the Raya deal is going to be made permanent. I think that the attributes he has that make him the kind of goalkeeper that Arteta and Iñaki Caña want to work with are relatively difficult to find. And I think that he is pretty well suited to that. I think he is their kind of, he's their goalie. And I don't think it's that easy to just get another one.
No, it's not. And you can't keep spending loads of money on goalkeepers like we did and continue to do. Like we probably spent more money on goalkeepers than we have on strikers under Mikel Arteta. I mean, it's true. We bought one striker in Gabriel Jesus.
Yeah.
And we've spent loads of money on Raya, loads of money on Ramsdale.
Some money on Matt Turner, some money on Renison.
Exactly. You know, and
probably more on goalies this summer.
Yeah, exactly. We can't keep doing that. Like, if you were to ask me, you know, would I like our Ederson, Alisson equivalent? Absolutely. Edu should be in Brazil this summer just looking up who's the fucking, who's the best big lad playing futsal somewhere up front, and bring him in and just say, right, you're a goalkeeper now. This is your new job. You're the goalkeeper for Arsenal. You know, I'm being facetious. Of course I would like that goalkeeper, but I also think we can't keep spending loads and loads of money on goalkeepers. We have to commit to one for a while, at least until something, you know, much, much better comes along. And I think that's kind of where we are with Raya right now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you say it's a back four that he's behind that's preventing chances being created, he is part of that unit and he does a lot of good work in sort of suppressing those shots. I don't think he's a truly elite shot stopper, but, you know, if there was, if the team do their job, that does, that hasn't been a problem for the vast majority of the season.
Yeah, that's true. But it is also part of the goalkeeper's job to be that last line of defense and, well, maybe to make the difference at times, you know?
I feel like it's almost redundant to talk about Alisson, because I think Alisson is sort of a freakish talent. Like, I think Alisson is streets ahead of everybody else in the Premier League. But if you look at the Liverpool defense and how many goals they've conceded versus how many shots they've faced and how many good chances they've faced, he, at various points, has been the difference for them. Not just this season, but stretching back 2 or 3 years. So, yeah, listen, if an upgrade opportunity like that becomes available, maybe it's a different conversation. I just think those players are few and far between.
Yes, I do agree. I do agree. What about this from W. Campo 33? He says, or they say, did this game typify the need for a give me the fucking ball, I'll do it striker? We have so many skillful team players, but yesterday I would have killed for someone to just plant themselves in the middle of the box and get on the end of a ball across the goal face. And there were quite a few of those. When the best finisher at the club is the second string left winger, he's referring to Trossard, a little bit harsh, but I know where he's coming from because we've just discussed that.
Yeah.
When he's the best finisher, that tells you we need something more. Personally, I would love to see Isak in an Arsenal shirt next year.
I don't think he's alone in that.
There's no.
People, I think Elliot on Arsenal Vision has been really banging that drum. A couple of goals against Spurs at the weekend won't have hurt as well. Listen, I think we need another forward. I think Isak would be really difficult given what Newcastle paid for him and what they'd likely want for him. But yeah, I know exactly what they mean. You know, someone who's a killer rather than a team guy would be a sort of nice contrast to the group. I agree with that. Do you?
Yeah. Yeah, like we've talked a lot about striker and we've talked a lot about forwards and, you know, the... Like, you have a game like yesterday and everyone will say what Arsenal could do or could be with a striker like Ollie Watkins. Like, does Ollie Watkins score that header at the back post that Gabriel Jesus misses? I don't know, but probably he gets it on target at the very least.
Yeah, and can he link play as well as, you know, a Gabriel Jesus? Or probably not. Probably not. But get him in that 18-yard box and he's hitting the target.
Yeah.
So maybe we, you know, maybe there's something to be said for that, you know, a bit more of a sort of a specialist.
Yeah. Like we've talked, haven't we? Like where I don't think it'll be Watkins. I don't think it'll be Tony. I don't think it'll be Isak. I would love Isak because he's got the age profile where you could probably justify the expenditure, whereas you can't necessarily with someone like Tony or someone like Watkins. You know, not that Villa would be willing to let him go when they get into the Champions League next season. I'm not sure he'd be willing to leave anyway because, you know, he's having a good time there and he's the main man. You know, if you could maybe talk yourself around to, okay, maybe Tony is enough of a missing piece to give us what we need to get us a little bit further in our development and maybe over the line when it comes to the title next season. You could maybe justify that expenditure. My gut feeling is that it will be, if we bring in that kind of a player, it'll be somebody a little less well known. I don't think it's going to be one of the big names for the big money, but the profile of player, I think, is quite obvious.
Yeah, because again, this might be a sort of glass half full feeling because we've lost a game, but sometimes it feels like we have to create such good chances to score. I mean, even Kai Havertz, when he's been playing at centre forward, you know, a lot of those goals of like, we get in behind, we cut it back to the perfect spot. It would be nice to be able to like sling across into the box and know you've got a guy in there who is going to get across his man and turn it into something, you know? Someone who can sort of take a hopeful situation and make it more dangerous than that by being dominant inside the box. I do think that would add another dimension to the squad. And I'm sure Arsenal think that too. So hopefully we get that as well in the summer.
All right. I mean, have you any more?
Not really. I mean, like I said, a lot of Zinchenko questions today. I suppose, what about this for a bit of a different perspective? Simon King, are we being too negative? Everyone said coming into this last stretch, all teams would drop points. Liverpool also dropped points. So we remain ahead of them. And this Villa team play the others. Is that true? No, they've already played City. Is this actually the best time to drop points to truly focus the team?
No, it's not the best time. It's nearly the worst time. But I know where he's coming from. It's a question of whether or not we can respond. It's a question of whether or not, like, when you're playing a lot of football and you're winning, your legs don't feel tired. Or the aches and strains that you have are things you can live with pretty easily. As soon as you lose a game or two, the fatigue feels more acute. Those aches and strains become unbearable pain, you know? So it's about whether or not we can respond. Like, again, it's this context of what we've done in 2024. It's been a brilliant run. Amazing. And the fact that one defeat in, what is it, 4 months? Well, 3.5 months. And of course, there was a bit of time off and some FA Cup games or whatever. But, you know, that we can all feel the significance of that defeat. It just tells us what we know about what's required to win the Premier League. And it feels like, and I'm not saying it is, but it feels like we've just let it slip. You know? But I hope it's something we can respond to. Arteta said that afterwards, it's easy when you're winning, when you win, it's easy to stand up and it's easy to be a leader and it's easy to, you know, be front and center. So he's challenging them to react and respond on Wednesday and beyond Wednesday. So I guess we'll see what they're made of and see how much metal there is in this particular group of players.
Yeah. My response to that would be, everyone said coming to the last stretch, all teams would drop points. I think part of the problem is, I think we've all sort of said Man City might not drop any points.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the thing with them. That is a genuine possibility. Yeah, I think the reaction's been sort of fairly proportionate, really, to what was a very disappointing result at a critical moment in the season.
Mm-hmm.
But as you keep saying, still a hell of a lot to play for. And the real frustration for me of the way last season finished was that we couldn't even force City to have to win those last couple of games, you know?
Mm.
I really hope this year we can at the very least, do that.
Yes, I hope so too. And as painful as this was, we have to put it behind us and we have to compartmentalize and just get on with what we have in front of us, because there's, you know, 6 more games in the Premier League, at least one more game in the Champions League. We're hoping for more games in the Champions League, which may well have an impact then on the Premier League. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd love for someone to come in and, you know, look, Edu's been there and done that, hasn't he? And there's players in the history of this football club who have experienced difficulties at this part of the season who've then been able to get going again and make sure that the season has ended the way we want. So a challenge, a bit of a pep talk, who knows? I hope we can do it. I hope we can do it. It feels from our perspective as fans that, you know, this has been a hammer blow and it might well turn out that way. But within that group, they've just got to get themselves back up and go again. And, you know, I know these are just words, but there is no other way. There is nothing else they can do. They can't, like, the players can feel sad and unhappy and what have you about the performance and the result yesterday, but they can't let that stay with them as they go into the games that are to come. They have to put it to one side.
I think they'll be glad, probably, of a shift in focus for the Champions League on Wednesday night.
Away from home as well, where we're really strong, remember?
We'll be fine then.
We'll be all right. We'll be all right. Those two Trossard goals off the bench will hit like crack, as they
say. Hey, and a quick congratulations, by the way, to Granit Xhaka and Leverkusen.
Holy shit, what a season.
Yeah, what a season. And what a goal from him. Do you see his goal in the game to win it? Yeah, he's had an outstanding campaign there, and glad that he could, you know, put last season behind him and lift the league this year, even if we don't. Literally, as I started talking then, I was like, oh, God, no.
Actually, I had just one more quick question from Lucas Chvapil, who's at Chvapil. Apologies if I butchered your name there, Lucas. On the back of Leverkusen winning the Bundesliga and yet to lose a game in any competition so far this season, which is kind of insane. He says, morning, gents. We can see young managers like Xavi and Xabi Alonso win league titles early in their managerial careers. Could we say that due to their playing career and multiple league titles, they are simply built for this better to get their teams over the line?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
I'm not sure, you know, how much that is the case, but I do think, you know, just having that experience of what this part of a season is like.
In big club culture, essentially.
Kinda, yeah.
Raised in that. I'm sure that is a factor. I mean, listen, Arteta was Pep's assistant, right, at Man City, and I think he would have learnt a lot about a winning culture there. He started his career at Barcelona, albeit not really with the first team. Won titles with Glasgow Rangers, won at the top end of the French league with PSG. But, yeah, you know, I think of Zidane, basically, who walked straight into Real Madrid and started collecting trophies. Winning is kind of a culture, and I suppose if you come from that culture, it's maybe easier than if you're sort of trying to assimilate into it.
If you're trying to change the ingrained culture of a club that's already there, which I think is something we've talked about a lot, about what he's tried to do or is trying to do at Arsenal in terms of that culture. And I think there is a very interesting discussion, and probably not one we can have right now because we've got to wrap this up. But when you talk about fans and fan reaction and expectation and disappointment and all of that stuff that comes with you know, being a big club with a winning culture, like, to what point does that become entitlement in a way? Do you know what I mean? Whereas, you know, Real Madrid, like, second favorites or favorites every year to win the league in Spain because of the stature of the club and because of the resources of the club. You know, Xabi Alonso won league titles with Real Madrid and Bayern Munich, but, you know, those are the clubs that win the titles. And I think, you know, the Premier League is a different situation, no?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, what I would say is it's obviously not something that's insurmountable. for someone like Arteta. You know, think of people who come from backgrounds where they're not even in football and win things, mm-hmm. you know, like a Jose Mourinho, or, you know, Arsene Wenger himself was not an elite player, but certainly won trophies in his managerial career. So I don't think it's something he can't get past, but it might be something that's helped Alonso, I would say.
Maybe so. What an amazing season they've had at Bayer Leverkusen. And congratulations
to
them. And yeah, Europa League, of course, as well. And they'll be in the Champions League next season. So they'll be a team to watch out for. All right. We are going to leave it there because we've gone on way too long. We'll get this podcast out to all of you. Those of you who are going to Munich, including you, James, safe travels. Have a good and successful time. Fingers crossed. We'll obviously talk to you a bit later in the week on Patreon. We'll preview the Bayern game and we'll talk about it afterwards as well. So for now, take it easy and we will catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.